Chapter 56. From Bletchley Blethering's, February 1944. Dutch gin, as served in the recreation hut, bears no resemblance to either Holland or gin. It's drinkable only when you've had the worst day in the world. For example, the kind of day BB had upon coming across the phrase zur Endlosung in the course of work. It referenced a transportation of Jews, and it means for the final solution. BB has never come across that particular expression before, but it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to fill in the possibilities, does it? Draft destroyed, unread by anyone but its author, and replaced with humorous write-up of BP chess tournament.
4 months, God help us. Preparations are well underway, better hope so.
The conversation in Commander Travis's office retreated as Mab picked up the tea tray and a stack of reports, closing the door behind her. It was all anyone had talked about since the year had turned. The Allied invasion of France, which Mab now knew was planned for June or thereabouts. She was also privy to the exact number of Lancaster bombers and flying fortresses headed to flatten Germany's airfields in long-term preparation for the invasion. Mab supposed indifferently that she was better informed about Britain's war plans than the cabinet. Ditching the tea tray, she went to lock up the files she'd just collected. Nothing important was ever to be left lying about unlocked, even for a moment. Mab knew one of these cabinets had reports about assassination attempts against Hitler, and reports about the new and improved computing machines here at BP that would supposedly crack Enigma traffic even faster than the bombs. But she didn't think about any of it. Her brain wasn't required in this new job. She was in administration now, filing, typing, and organizing records. Pure secretarial work, something to get up for each morning, but requiring no deep thought or focus. Mab came off shift at last, and 10 minutes later had her first drink sitting in front of her at the recreation hut. She downed 2 Dutch gins in quick succession, then ordered a pint of lager and sipped slowly. 2 quick, 1 slow, that was the ticket. Get drunk too quickly and she'd end up weeping into her glass. 2 slow and she wouldn't get as numb as she needed in order to sleep. 2 quick, 1 slow, repeat for 4 hours, until it came time to sway dizzily toward the transport bus. She was fine. It was all fine. She rummaged in her handbag for a cigarette, squinting when she found the ring of keys for the cabinets where she'd finished today's filing in the mansion. She'd forgot to turn them into the watchman in the main hall. He already had another set, thank goodness, so she'd just pop back in and hand us over when she left here. All was well as long as the keys stayed on park ground and were never left unattended.
Queen Mab, you gorgeous thing. May I get you a drink? Giles asked, his face agreeably out of focus. Any good gossip?
Dropping his voice to a near whisper under the cheerful noise of off-duty codebreakers drinking, playing table tennis and dealing bridge in the background.
Has Travis hit the bottle yet from the stress of the coming invasion?
I'm not saying a thing about work, Giles. Even 3 drinks in, half drowning in grief, and ensconced here at the heart of BP, the knee-jerk was reflexive.
Darling girl, I want gossip, not work secrets. Bletchley Blethering's isn't very funny these days, letting down the side. So tell me whose nerves are in a lather picking the invasion date. Tell me if the PM really is screaming down the line every other day about Montgomery. We can't talk secrets, but we can talk people. Nothing? Well, I've got plenty for you. The Glasbro twins have joined the Mad Hatters, you know, the brunettes in Hut 16. My God, but they're irritating. They never stop giggling. If that's what youth is coming to, we should throw in the towel and let Hitler have the empire. We're reading Bleak House, by the way, for the monthly pick. I'll save you 500 pages. It's bleak.
Mab remembered ploughing through most of Dickens on 100 classic literary works for the well-read lady. Had she ever finished the list? Not that it mattered now.
You missed at the tea parties, Mab. The Mad Hatters aren't the same without you. Osler's too gloomy lately to provide much sparkle. Have you heard the whispers about that prince of hers? And sweet Beth may be brilliant, but she's never been one for banter. Though I confess there's a certain amusement value in watching her and Harry sit across from each other, pretending they haven't just been at it like rabbits in the air raid cellar. Who those two think they're fooling, I have no idea.
Mab swallowed the rest of her drink, ordered another. The sides of her head felt soft. She looked past Giles and sat bolt upright. Francis was sitting in the far corner of the recreation hut. His back was to her, but those were unmistakably his stocky shoulders, his hair with its tracing of grey. She slid off the stool so quickly she almost fell, pushing past a quartet of bridge players.
Excuse me. It was Francis. He was alive and he was going to turn round smiling and tell her Lucy was asleep in the nursery. Her hand fell on his shoulder. The man turned his head and it wasn't Francis. Of course it wasn't. Just a stocky fellow with a red face, nothing like Francis. Mab nearly wept. She turned and blundered back toward her stool, missing it as she tried to slide back on. Careful! Giles put a hand on her shoulder. You don't look too steady on your pins. Mab had been cursed like this since Christmas, seeing Francis and Lucy everywhere, but not really seeing them at all. Every skinny-legged girl playing with a ball turned into Lucy. Every man with a chestnut gleam in his hair was Francis. Mab knew her mind was playing tricks, but she couldn't stop running up to strangers, hoping against all reason. Cruel, mad mind. Crueler, madder world. Turn it off. She swallowed the dregs of her beer and looked at Giles, stretching her lips into a smile. You were saying... She didn't listen to his answer, just kept nodding and sipping until the world transformed into fizzing and sparks. Mab woke with sunlight in her eyes. She sat up, looked around a strange room with a sheet sliding down her naked body, pain splitting her skull, and realized Giles lay stretched out in the bed beside her.
No need to blitz out of here like you're making for the last lifeboat off the Titanic.
Mab straightened, a wave of nausea rolling through her stomach, snatching up her clothes, which had apparently been dropped on the floor wherever they fell. This had to be Giles's bedroom. He'd been one of the lucky ones billeted in the shoulder of mutton. He was sitting up in bed, red hair standing on end, coverlet drawn to his waist. Mab's stomach rolled again. Am I late for shift? Perhaps it was a pathetic point of pride, but all the time she'd stumbled home to bed half drunk, she had never once allowed it to make her late the following day. She'd failed all her promises to Lucy, she'd failed all her promises to Francis, but she hadn't failed the oath to her country. Giles!
It's not even six.
He reached for the pack of gitanes on his night table. She would have sagged in relief, but that was only the first of the worries making her stomach clench. She began, still clutching the clothes against her own nakedness. Giles appeared to be wearing his drawers still, but she could hardly bear to look. She didn't remember a single thing past being helped through BP's main gates.
We did not.
He struck a match.
Try not to look quite so surprised, will you? You were keen enough last night, and I admit I was fairly keen too, but you were out cold the moment your back hit the mattress. I don't require protestations of eternal love from the women I take to bed, but I do require consciousness. So I put the covers over you and climbed in myself for some shut-eye. I'd have taken the couch like a gentleman, but as you see...
He gestured around the tiny room.
There isn't one.
Thank you. I'm sorry to impose. Mab managed to pull her slip over herself. Her stomach churned again. What else did I do? What spectacle did I make of myself? This had never happened before, in all her hours of drinking at the recreation hut. How had she got drunk and thrown herself at Giles, of all people? An entirely different panic seized her as she remembered her ring of keys from the mansion. She grabbed her handbag. Giles, my keys!
Relax, darling. You insisted on dropping them with the main hall watchman before we came here. You might have been plastered, but irresponsible? Never.
Mab exhaled relief. Can I use your washstand? Giles exhaled a cloud of smoke.
Be my guest.
The water was freezing cold, just enough to gulp down a half glass, then splash the rest over her face and neck. Straightening, she looked at herself in the mirror and recoiled. The soot with which she meticulously blackened her lashes in place of mascara now ran down her cheeks like black tears, and her hair was a rat's nest. She didn't look like Frances Grey's elegant wife in her chic hats and perfectly shined shoes. She didn't even look like Mab Chert, the pugnacious Shoreditch girl in rayon frocks, who was going to tow Lucy out of the hole they'd both been born in.
You cry in your sleep.
Giles's voice came quietly behind her. Mab began crying now, hunched over the basin.
You've had a rotten time, haven't you?
Giles stretched out a pale, freckled arm.
Don't be ashamed. You were drowning your sorrows last night, and frankly, so was I.
Somehow Mab found herself crawling onto the bed and under his arm. She shook, racked by sobbing, as Giles passed her a handkerchief and talked lightly in a way that required no reply.
I used to have a dreadful pash for you, you know. I got over it when you married the war poet, though I can't say my luck got any better, because I promptly lost my head for another woman I can't have. Which is why I thought last night it might be a good idea to forget about her in your arms. But you're the one who needs arms right now. Poor Mab.
Squeezing her shoulders, Mab's sobs were subsiding, even as her head continued to throb.
Part of me envies you, Giles continued. At least your Francis loved you back. I can't even get Beth to look in my bloody direction.
He wasn't really equating his unrequited crush with Francis's death, she knew. He was trying to distract her, and she was grateful.
Giles, don't tell me you've lost your head over Beth.
Mab pressed the heels of her hands to her eyes.
Ever since getting transferred to ISK, you can't really know someone at BP till you see them work. I never knew what Beth did until I came there.
Giles whistled.
When she's really working, she practically shimmers. I used to think I was fairly bright, but here everyone has a first from Oxford or translates Egyptian papyri. Brains like mine are plain tuppence pieces to Beth's golden guinea. Harry, now, he's a solid pound sterling. No wonder she looked past me and snapped him up.
I'm sorry, Mab managed to say.
Well, I'll get over it. A shrug. Besides, if I wait a bit, Harry might bugger off home to his wife and Beth might look my way. A chap can dream, eh? Until then.
Giles placed his last half inch of cigarette in the saucer on the bedside table and cupped a hand to her cheek.
You've got someone you'd like to forget, and I do too. Now that we're both sober, what do you say we give it a try?
Part of her wanted to, just to get out of her own miserably aching head. But he was Giles, one of her few remaining friends, and he didn't deserve a woman who was only going to shut her eyes and wish he was someone else.
I can't, Giles.
He smiled, dropping his hand.
Then what do you say to breakfast, my queen?
Chapter 57. From Bletchley Blethering's, March 1944. Trains and train stations, what a thing they become in wartime. How many heartbreaks and homecomings, ecstasies and agonies have we experienced with a rocking floor, a platform crowd, and a sweaty ticket clutched in hand. This time Osler was the one to wait on the platform at Euston. A gleam of ash-gold hair, there was Philip, right on time, coming through the crowd with his loose-limbed stride. He hadn't written since Christmas, or invited her to meet up before today. He'd said he was up to his ears, reassigned to a new W-class destroyer in Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Perfectly reasonable, Osler thought, watching him approach. She was up to her ears too. The clock was ticking down to June and the planned invasion, and the hut for translators was swamped. But her mental insistence that things were fine couldn't entirely banish Philip's cool voice at Claridge's.
You never really answered my question last night. Why you stopped writing?
And the voice of Philip's friend, David.
He and Princess Elizabeth sparked like a bonfire.
Philip stopped before her.
Hello, Princess.
Eyes travelling over her blush-pink dress, the same one she'd worn the very first time they'd met at this spot, and landing on his naval insignia pinned between her breasts. He smiled despite himself, scooping up her hand and kissing it.
I'm only in town the one night. Tomorrow it's back to Newcastle. Lots to do, overseeing the Whelp's finishing touches.
Whelp? What's a name for a fighting ship?
She's a nice, fast piece of work.
He waxed technical, hands flying. He wanted to be back at sea, Osler knew. A man like Philip was meant for heavy seas and dodging fire, not squiring ladies around London.
And you?
He tucked her hand in his arm, drawing her back toward the shelter of the wall. A train had just roared in, soldiers spilling out, hauling kit bags, harried-looking women scolding children.
What are you up to in that dull job of yours, Oz?
Yesterday, my fellow translators and I were all having a good snicker at Herr Hitler, Osler thought. The Führer seems to have written off the idea that the Allied invasion is coming through France. He thinks it'll be Norway. Isn't that an absolute screamer, Philip? You really have to wonder about Hitler. If a lot of dabbling debs can point out there's no practical way a huge amphibious force could bang through those North Sea choppers and then clamber over those rocky shores inland, you'd think the supreme leader of a Reich that's supposed to last 1,000 years could figure it out. But he hasn't. And a hut full of women is laughing their heads off at his expense. That's my week in a nutshell. Isn't it a hoot? Oh, you know, nothing to tell.
Osler squeezed his arm. According to your friend David, you've got something to tell. He rang me after Christmas, saying poor Lilibet has a mad crush on you. I hope you haven't broken our princess's heart.
She made her voice warm and teasing, inviting him to laugh. But Philip glanced down at her, and an expression shifted across his face.
I wondered if you'd heard anything.
Is there anything to hear?
No, there isn't.
Then what? Osler didn't know where to go with that, so she trailed off. They stood silent on the platform. How much time had they spent here, waiting for each other?
Philip, I'm not jealous. Though I think that was David's aim. Why else call up your friend's girl and tell her he spent Christmas getting ogled by a 17-year-old in pantomime tights?
Philip sounded clipped.
Elizabeth is far too young for people to be hashing out wedding plans.
Wedding plans? Osler's heart pounded unpleasantly. Who's hashing those? A pause.
I'd rather not talk about this anymore, Oz.
I'm not trying to pry into royal matters, she managed to say. But you gave me this to wear, touching the naval insignia. And you've told me you loved me more than once over the last 4 years. Even if things have been strained lately, I think I have a right to know if your name is being seriously bandied about in wedding plans to someone else.
It isn't, he rounded. Far too early for that.
Well, isn't that topping? There really was something then, something besides idle whispers. Osler let out a slow breath. Shall I wait a year or two and bring it up then? Will that still be too early or too late?
Osler, let's drop this. Go get Dover sole and champagne at the Savoy. I've lost my appetite.
They stood looking at each other. The platform was almost empty. The crowd from the last train had cleared out, and passengers for the next had yet to gather.
I'm not discussing this here, Philip said at last. Osler heard the bite of royal disdain that so rarely cropped up in his voice, disdain for saying anything remotely personal in public.
This is about as close as we'll get to private, Your Highness, given that we don't have a room at Claridge's this time. So I'd like to hear what is happening with you and dear cousin Lilibet. He thrust his hands into his pockets.
She's fond of me, he said finally. She has been since she was 13.
That's a silly girl's crush.
She's not silly. She's very serious, actually. Solemn. She knows what she wants.
And she wants you. And now that she's nearly 18, the age I was when I met you, people are starting to think about whom she might marry one day.
I suppose.
He looked restless.
I've never given it a thought, Oz. I'm still not. I've got a ship to think about. I'm heading out to fight. That's what I'm thinking about. There's a war on.
I know there's a war on, Osler wanted to shriek. I know. But something else went on at the same time war did, and that was life. It kept right on going up until the moment it stopped. And this was hers, limping along like a horse suddenly gone lame, all because someone had chucked an obstacle in her path called Lilibet.
So she's thinking about you, but you aren't thinking about her.
Osler kept her voice level.
Why are you so edgy then? And why have you been avoiding me since Christmas?
I wasn't.
Yes, you were.
A long pause.
My family's got the bit in their teeth, he finally said. Some guests at Christmas noticed the lay of the land, with Lilibet, I mean, and that's how my cousin George got wind of it.
George is in the King of Greece, currently in exile from the throne.
Suddenly the whole family's buzzing. Uncle Dicky loves the idea. Cousin Marina won't let it go. She's written my mother. Everyone's harping on the possibility.
So?
Osler folded her arms. They can't force you down the aisle because they want an alliance, Philip. This isn't the Middle Ages.
I have obligations.
He couldn't look her in the eye.
They're my family.
Which family members would that be? The ones in exile from their own homeland, or the ones allied with Hitler? You have told me for years that you feel you hardly have a family at all, and now that you might potentially make a match of it with the future Queen of England, their wishes are suddenly paramount.
I have obligations, he repeated flatly.
You have other obligations first, as you pointed out. There's a war on, Lieutenant, and fascists to fight. But what if we get to the other side of this war and your solemn, serious princess is still taking a dead set at you?
A long pause.
Then my family will expect me to step forward.
Osler unfolded her arms, clasping her hands together to keep them from trembling.
And what will you do?
Another long pause. Osler turned and took a seat by the wall, remembering the blackout when she and Philip had sat there all night kissing. She took some deep breaths, waiting for the tightness in her throat to subside.
Were you ever doing more than... marking time with me.
You know it's more than that, is it?
You love me, I know you do. But did you ever mean it to last?
A brittle laugh.
You didn't, did you? What you said to me the night we met,
I'll lay odds you're hard to get over. I never promised you it was going to last.
Philip dropped down beside her, linking his hands between his knees.
You're too good for me by half. That is a bunch of noble bloody rubbish.
Another way of saying you're not good enough. But I am, Philip. I'm of age, I'll have money of my own, I run in the same circles as you, and I've always been good enough. Yet I'm still just the one you telephone for a night out.
She lifted her chin, refusing to look away.
It has been 4 years. Why did you never...
Be fair. I never took things far enough in the first place to raise your expectations.
You mean because you never took me to bed? You think you're in the clear?
Well, keep your voice down.
There are other ways of raising expectations, Philip.
They were both shaking. Philip looked, Osla thought, like he wanted to give her a good slap. She wanted to claw his face bloody. But it wouldn't have taken much for them to fall into each other's arms, either. It never had. She tore her eyes away, staring at the tracks as another train rushed in. They both sat waiting as another flood of passengers jostled off, pushing for the stairs. Waited until the train pulled away and the platform was empty again.
Maybe you should go home.
Philip's voice was back under control.
We'll talk when I get more than a night off from the whelp.
And go back to how things were. Is that what you're suggesting?
How they are, Oz. You know how I feel about you. Nothing has changed.
Sorry, Philip. Having already given you 4 years, I don't really feel like pouring more of my heart into you.
The words scraped out of her throat like broken glass.
Not when I know you're ready to put on royal racing colours the minute Cousin Lilibet trots to the starting post.
Don't talk about her like she's a horse, he flared. She's got feelings, you know.
So do I.
Osla tried to swallow around the spike in her throat.
Do you love her?
I was curled up around you at Christmas time. You think I'd bounce from that to falling for a girl barely out of the schoolroom?
I don't know. What would your family expect?
Pause.
Could you love her?
The longest silence yet. Osla's heart contracted as if it was shrinking away from him.
I think that might be a yes, she managed to say.
He looked at the ground between his feet, as if seeing something else.
The world she lives in. At Christmas, I got to see them all behind the scenes a bit more. Her family's not like mine, scattered and quarrelling. Us four, the king is always saying, so proud. Just a man and his wife and his two daughters, that's what they are, by themselves, not grand.
Not grand? A family with what, 10 palaces?
You know what they do in those palaces? They drink tea and listen to the gramophone and laugh while dogs flop about on everyone's shoes. Margaret reads a magazine while her mother talks horses and Lilibet and her father go walking. I could be part of that, Philip finished, low-voiced. That's the honey in the pot, Osla thought sickly.
Not just a princess who was a suitable match for a prince, not even the fact that his relatives approved. Princess Elizabeth brought the one thing those without homes couldn't resist, the thing Osla herself wanted desperately. Lilibet came with a family ready-made, close-knit and loving, a family all tied up in a bow with the future Queen of England, who was a serious girl rather than a silly Deb. An oasis in the desert, surely, for a boy raised without a home, a boy who'd grown into an ambitious man. Osla knew Philip so well, of course he was ambitious. What man in his lonely, bare-bones position would turn down such a chance? Status, wealth, power, allied to a loving family and a girl he thought he might very well be able to love.
No one, Osla thought. I can't think about any of this yet, Philip went on. Not until the war is done. There's not room for it. But Lilibet said she'd keep writing. She's never stopped.
He looked at Osla.
You stopped.
The breath left Osla as if she'd been punched.
I've told you things I never told anyone, Oz, about Cape Matapan, lining up targets in the dark and watching them go down. Then I go off to sea again and you stop writing, so I think you're cooling off, you're backing away, and I should let you because you're right. I didn't get into things with you thinking it was something for the long run. So if you want to back off, it's only fair to let you. But I get home and you're in my arms at Christmas like nothing's happened, and you've got my head spinning all over again, but you won't tell me why you went off me, or even that you'll write again. I may have misled you, but we're pots and kettles here. You've misled me too.
That's not my fault, Uzzler wanted to snarl. I've protected you. I stayed away to keep London intelligence off your back. But she couldn't say any of that. He waited for explanations, but the Official Secrets Act sat around her neck like a lead collar.
At least with Lilibet, he said at last. I know where I am.
Do you know who you are with her? Uzzler lashed back. With me, you'd simply be Philip. With her, you'd always be the Queen's husband. Do you think you're built for that, playing Albert to her Victoria? I don't think you are. You'll be dead of boredom in 3 years.
Now he was the one who looked like he'd been hit. The silence stretched, endless, taut, terrible. Somewhere distant, a clock chimed. Finally, Uzzler rose, unpinned the naval insignia from her dress, and placed it in his palm.
Good luck with the whelp.
Avoiding his stricken gaze, she walked carefully, one step after the other, across the platform toward the ticket booth, where she could find out what the next train was back to Bletchley. Part of Uzzler hoped Philip would come after her, that the pull between them would defeat the promise of a family, and a royal one at that. But she knew he wouldn't. She knew something else as well. If she put enough steps in line, one after the other, she would get there, to the ticket booth, to Bletchley, to the rest of her life, without crumbling into pieces. In the grand scheme of things, losing Philip wasn't remotely important. Not in a world where there were invasions of Europe being planned, where millions around the globe were dying. It didn't matter at all that she felt like she was being torn apart inside by white-hot pincers.
You'll get over it, Uzzler told herself. There's a war on.
Philip's voice came softly behind her.
Let me at least take you home, princess.
Uzzler flinched like a lash had torn across her back. She turned in time to see Philip frozen mid-sentence, visibly realizing how ill-advised that choice of endearments had been. She stood, spine straight, letting him get a good look at the rage in her eyes.
I'm no princess, Philip, she said at last. You've already got one.
Chapter 58. From Bletchley Blethering's, April 1944. A thought, Boffins and Debs, and BB is aware it's a radical one. Can we all perhaps retire the word wog from our vocabularies? Such an amusing term, such a joke, such an affectionate bit of slang to toss about in a moment of high-spirited fun. Yet BB does not find the term particularly entertaining, and neither do those who hear it aimed at them, judging from their expressions.
Get off!
Beth waded into the scrum of children, grabbing a tow-headed boy and a red-headed boy. They had Christopher Zarb on the ground in his own front yard and were pelting him with mud.
He won't fight, the redhead jeered, just like his dad.
Beth hauled off and smacked him on the back of the head.
Get out of here,
the boys ran.
My mum says you don't deserve to live in England if you won't fight for it, one yelled over his shoulder. Stupid wogs!
Christopher sat in the dirt, trying not to cry, brushing mud off his braces. Beth's heart squeezed.
Don't listen to them.
She held out a hand, rather awkwardly, to her lover's son.
Come on, we'll get you cleaned up.
Sheila was inside, laying out bread and marge for this month's tea party, but she swooped down on her muddied son.
Was it that Robbie Blaine again? The little bugger. You take care of Christopher, Beth said. I'll finish up here.
She was early, the first one arrived. Harry came in as she was putting the kettle on, and he looked grim as Beth told him what had happened.
Those little bastards have been after him for months. When I bang their heads together, their father's come at me.
Harry passed her a tea towel.
With luck, it'll slack off by next week.
What happens then? A long pause.
I leave.
He looked her in the eye.
I've enlisted, Beth.
A frozen, crystallized moment as they stood there in the cramped kitchen. Then Beth let out a short, incredulous laugh.
You aren't allowed.
It is if you go for the Fleet Air Arm, Harry said quietly. The Naval Air Service. Anyone shot down in the Fleet Air Arm goes down at sea. No risk of capture. No risk to BP.
Commander Travis wouldn't...
Travis gave permission to Keith Beatty in Hut 6 back in June 42. Now me. I was going to tell you after the tea party, but...
Harry took a breath.
It's done, Beth.
No!
It came out reflexively, rushing through her throat in something very close to a whimper. She stood clutching the tea towel, suddenly terrified.
I see you told her.
Sheila stalked into the kitchen, pushing a strand of hair back into its string snood.
You talk to him, Beth. I've already worn my voice out. Maybe if he won't listen to his bloody wife, he'll listen to his bloody mistress.
Glaring at Harry.
Be fair, he said, attempting levity. Mistress implies a kept woman, and nobody's keeping Beth anywhere she doesn't want to be.
The joke fell flat. Sheila turned around and began slamming cups about, leaving Beth to the attack. She crossed her arms, swallowing her fear.
How long have you been planning this?
January.
When she and Harry had quarreled over which was the worthier fight, the fight with a gun or the fight with a pencil, neither of them had mentioned that quarrel since. Harry had been tender, pulling her into the cradle of his big body every time they came together, and she'd fallen into him gratefully, glad not to rehash the argument. She'd been grateful, and he'd been planning this all along. Beth gulped in a long breath, and with the air came rage.
You idiot, she told Harry. Your section needs you.
Quite honestly, they don't. This isn't 41, not enough people and everyone's scrambling. It's not even 42 with the terrible shutout. You know how big my section is now? BP's turned into a well-oiled machine, thousands of cogs all doing their jobs. One cog won't matter.
You aren't a cog. They can find more chess players and math students, but they can't find another Harry Zarb.
Her words scrambled, tumbled, pleaded.
They can't replace you.
Yes, they can.
His voice was gentle, and she hated it.
I'm not special, Beth. You could do my job better than me. So can women like Joan Clark, who's one of the best brains in my section. That was the argument that clinched Travis. The ladies here have proved they are perfectly capable of handling the work, so let them do it, and let the men who want to join up go to the front while they can.
Pause.
There's a big push soon. You know there is.
The Allied invasion. Everyone knew what was coming.
You can't say one more body in that fight won't make a difference.
Harry continued in that gentle voice.
Everyone will count. Any number of qualified women can do my job, but those women can't join the Fleet Air Arm, which I can. And the Fleet Air Arm needs men.
They don't need you!
But that argument wasn't working, so Beth switched tack.
What about your son? He needs both of you.
Sheila's parents have agreed to take up the slack.
That will be a joy, Sheila muttered at the sink, banging cups. You get to slag krauts over the Atlantic, and I get to listen to my mother tell me I'm doing Christopher's braces up wrong.
If you go down in the middle of the ocean, he will be fatherless. She will be widowed.
Beth waved at Sheila.
Are you that selfish, Harry?
No.
A glint entered his voice like a gleam of metal.
What's selfish is keeping myself bunked up in a safe, cushy job here in Bucks, while every other able-bodied man in this country is expected to put his life on the line. They have children and wives, too. It doesn't exempt them from the danger. I have no right to keep myself safe for my family when they can't do the same, simply because they don't have my university degree and my easy out.
Oh, don't be so everlastingly noble!
Beth snarled as Sheila snapped, Christ, you're an ass! Harry just looked at them both steadily, immovable as a granite pillar in the cramped kitchen.
I'm going,
he said when they were finished.
I love that boy upstairs more than the world, and I love both of you. But I'm going.
To her own horror, Beth flew at him and began hitting him wherever she could reach. She couldn't stop. The panic was clawing its way out of her like a trapped bird.
Bastard!
She jerked, realizing she was on the edge of tears, slamming at him with her fists.
You bastard!
Harry stood quietly, taking the blows. Sheila was the one who yanked her back.
Stop that! People are looking!
At the door, Beth saw a cluster of newly arrived Mad Hatters, hesitating uncertainly, Giles and Mab, the wide-eyed Glasborough twins. Beth turned away to hide her face as Harry awkwardly welcomed everyone inside. She wanted to keep pounding at him till he was bloody. She wrapped her arms around herself, hunching her shoulders, humiliated to have lost control so completely.
Why were they arguing?
She heard Valerie Glasborough whisper to her twin as they went into the parlour.
Does someone have to tell you what a menage a trois is, child? Giles asked, overhearing. It's not going to be me.
Beth seized her coat.
I'm not staying. Harry followed her out into the spring twilight.
Beth, you're a bloody mathematician, not a flyer.
She wrenched away before he could touch her arm. You can do so much more here at BP, and you're still going to leave out of some misplaced sense of nobility, and you're going to die in the middle of the Atlantic.
Beth felt tears rising up her throat at the thought of Harry's sinking under a glinting sea in a plane riddled by Luftwaffe fire. His complicated, questing brain turned to grey pudding, never to work out U-boat settings or theorise mathematical proofs again. The war had made a waste of so many men. Why did it have to waste her beautiful, brilliant Harry?
Do you love me?
Harry had asked her in January, and she hadn't known how to answer. Was this his way of finding out?
I hate you,
she whispered, aware she sounded like a child, too devastated to care.
Don't you dare write me when you leave, you walking dead fool. Don't you dare.
9 days until the royal wedding. November 11, 1947. Chapter 59. Inside the clock. It was only in the darkest, bleakest hour right before dawn that Beth could ever bring herself to contemplate the last name on her list for the position of Bletchley Park traitor. Giles, a possibility. Peggy, another possibility. The rest of Dilly's section, suspects every one. And finally, Harry. Beth squeezed her eyes shut in the blackness of night, pushing down a fit of coughing. Not Harry. But he had worked Knox's section from time to time when they needed extra hands. She could even remember his arguing for greater aid to the Soviets back in the days when they'd been losing millions to Hitler's eastern advance. Harry, a traitor. It can't have been Harry, Beth thought, defending him as she had 1,000 times. It wasn't just a cry of he wouldn't do that to me. Harry had been in the Fleet Air Arm when the traitor wrecked Beth's life. But what if he hadn't gone to the Fleet Air Arm? What if that had only been an excuse and he'd gone elsewhere? If he'd somehow monitored activity in ISK, or had someone monitoring it for him when Beth finally cracked that fatal message of Dilly's abandoned cipher? Far-fetched. But in 3.5 years, Harry had never come to Clockwell. When the war ended, she'd pinned her hopes on seeing him come striding through the iron gates. He might not have been able to leave his regiment during the fight, but when the war was over, Harry would have come for her. Even if they'd quarrelled before he left, nothing would have kept him away if he'd learned she was here.
They're going to perform surgery on me, Harry.
Beth thought of her silent go-playing partner, her one friend, taken away for surgery, not returned yet. A lobotomy like Beth. Who knew?
They'll cut me open, and I don't know what they'll do after that. Come get me before.
But he'd never come. So, on one extreme he was dead and had never learned what happened to Beth. On the other extreme he was the traitor and he'd put her here, and he didn't care if she died here. Beth buried her head in her pillow and wept. York.
Is this about my piece on Ascot hats?
Osler cradled the telephone between ear and shoulder, hooking up her stockings. She hadn't expected her boss from the Tatler to ring her here in York.
I winged it over your desk before I left London.
Yes, I saw it.
Can I take a punt at turning it into a sort of upper-crust satire? It'll be an absolute screamer.
No, keep it straightforward. But this isn't about your piece, Miss Kendall.
Osler glanced at the time. If she was late checking out, she'd miss her morning train to Clockwell.
You asked for a few days off. I think we'd better make your absence indefinite, until after the royal wedding.
She felt her jaw tightening.
Scandal rags still got the swithers.
Ringing round the clock for you. Take time away until things die down. It's not as if the world will fall apart if we don't have articles on Ascot hats.
Osler breathed through her nose.
When can I come back?
Well, you're getting married soon, so
what's that got to do with it?
No one ever seemed to believe Osler wanted to work. Maybe fluffy, funny pieces on Ascot hats weren't exactly changing the world. But after translating so much tragedy at BP, Osler thought the world needed fluff and fun. She loved her job, dammit.
I have no intention of stopping after the wedding.
Is your chap on board with that?
Who cares? Osler wondered, reaching for her shoes.
I don't make a fuss who he fizzes the sheets with behind my back. He won't make a fuss about my job. She issued her boss a few reassurances, rang off, then telephoned her fiancé. No answer, and she put down the handset with a guilty twinge of relief that she wouldn't have to talk to him, conjure up a story.
You could do better, darling, her mother had told her upon meeting Osler's future husband. Really, you could.
No, I can't, Osler thought now, thumb running over her emerald ring. If Philip had taught her anything, it was not to trust passion. Far better to settle for reality, a job she loved and a friend she liked, even if he called her kitten and was probably gadding the weekend away with some tart from Whitstable. Hauling her travelling case downstairs, Osler hailed the doorman.
If you'd be a lamb and call me a taxi.
She stopped, leaning against a well-maintained old Bentley parked opposite, looking smart in black trousers, enormous sunglasses and a slouch-brimmed hat. Was Mab. 3 years ago. May, 1944. Chapter 60. Letter from Osler to her Café de Paris Good Samaritan. Please tell me broken hearts aren't fatal. Please tell me this feeling won't kill me. Right now I wish it would. Float me a message in a bottle, Mr. Cornwall, and tell me it will be all right. You could feel it, Osler thought, when something big was coming at Bletchley Park. Maybe no one traded details of their work, but you couldn't mistake the taut, febrile excitement in the canteen when waves of cryptanalysts sprinted in, bolted revolting platefuls of cheese and piccalilli without complaining, and sprinted out with pencils already in hand. You felt it. The temperature across BP rose like mercury in a thermometer. The invasion was coming. Not that other matters didn't intrude, however.
Osler, do you see the traffic in your section on the Fleet Air Arm?
Beth spoke in a low rush, abruptly sitting down beside Osler in the canteen.
I need to know what planes go down, what the casualty rates are.
Oh, Beth. Osler looked at her billet maid, who had been pulling more shifts than ever since Harry left for training. Her complexion looked like ash. Osler pushed her plate over.
Eat my kippers. You're skinny as a hat rack. Just give me the numbers.
Osler pushed a curl behind one ear. Her head ached, her hands were yellow from applying makeup to her legs after her last pair of stockings bit the dust. And oh, yes, she still woke up every morning thinking Philip and waiting for the accompanying stab of agony. So far, the plan of utterly ignoring a broken heart on the theory that it wasn't important during wartime was not really working terribly well.
I see some of the traffic about the Fleet Air Arm, she told Beth, who looked every bit as dead inside as Osler felt. Are the odds as bad as for the RAF?
Osler chose her words carefully.
When they're shot down there, things are much more final than with the RAF, because they can't bail out over land and make their way home. Tell me if you see anything about...
I'm not allowed, Beth. I can't.
Yes, you can!
Beth's voice scaled up.
We're not over an open telephone line. We're not out in public. We're inside BP. You can tell me.
It's not your...
Osler!
Beth was getting looks across the crowded canteen now, hunched toward Osler with everything in her body saying, please. A pause, and Osler found herself nodding.
I'll look up the latest traffic.
A minor breach in secrecy, but one everyone let slide. The huts were too full of women keeping anxious eyes on husbands and brothers at the front for there not to be a little discreet information trading. Osler couldn't stop herself from looking for the whelp, now that it had sailed for the Pacific, no matter how many times she told herself it wasn't her business any longer. Why couldn't hearts simply be reset, dialed back until they felt no more than the usual sympathy one felt for any man heading to war? Looking at Beth's reddened eyes, Osler thought her billet mate might be wondering the same thing.
Thank you, Beth said low-voiced. I'm sorry to ask.
Oh, plug it. If I can't bend a rule just a little for you of all people, what am I good for? Osler felt a sudden rush of affection. All right, she didn't have Philip, but she had friends. More than the daytime friends like Sally Norton and the other translators. She had friends like Beth, whom she would never have met if not for this war. Strange, quirky, brilliant Beth, who had recently confessed in a midnight heart-to-heart that she was deathly afraid of having no work like this once the war was done.
I have to get back to my section, Beth said now, and in a blink was back to being crisp and calm.
The workload was killing everyone else with this run-up toward the invasion, but for Beth it seemed to be revivifying,
Osler envied her.
She worked on the week's issue of Bletchley Blethering's, then realized as soon as she got back to her block that it would have to be scrapped. There was much bigger news for BB than a lampoon of the Highland Reel Club.
"The date's been finalized," said their head,
looking over the assembled naval section.
6th June, last hours of the 5th, if the weather's good to us."
Osler felt her fingernails digging into her palms.
"All leaves have been cancelled," he went on. "Our focus is now on intercepts regarding positions of German mines in the channel. Good hunting, ladies."
Osler exhaled slowly. Maybe this was the purpose she'd been driving for the entire war, the time and place to finally prove herself. In 3 short weeks, amphibious vessels would be clawing through channel waters for Normandy. "Let's sweep their path." She reached for her German dictionary. Mine, mine-laying, mine-ship. Time to buckle down.